Psalm 86, if you would please, Psalm 86 this morning. This morning, we're going to start a new series. During the summertime, we try to do a short series that gets us out of sync with what we've been doing, and it gets us just a little bit of a break in a short series. Lets us think through things a little bit differently. And so we're going to look at the philosophy of ministry for Valley View. Now, we've not done this together for a while, but I think it's important for us as we examine some texts that will help us just to be anchored in where we're at. Psalm 86, let's read this passage, and then we'll work through it together today. Psalm 86 is a prayer of David. He says, "Incline your ear, O Lord, and answer me, for I am poor and needy. Preserve my life, for I am godly. Save your servant who trusts in you. You are my God. Be gracious to me, O Lord, for to you do I cry all the day. Gladden the soul of your servant, for to you, O Lord, do I lift up my soul. For you, O Lord, are good and forgiving, abounding in steadfast love to all who call upon you. Give ear, O Lord, to my prayer. Listen to my plea for grace. In the day of trouble, I call upon you, for you answer me. There's none like you among the gods, O Lord, nor are there any works like yours. All the nations you have made shall come and worship before you, O Lord, and shall glorify your name. For you are great and do wondrous things. You alone are God. Teach me your way, O Lord, that I may walk in your truth. Unite my heart to fear your name. I give thanks to you, O Lord, my God, with my whole heart, and I will glorify your name forever. For great is your steadfast love toward me. You have delivered my soul from the depths of Sheol. O God, insolent men have risen up against me. A band of ruthless men seeks my life, and they do not set you before them. But you, O Lord, are a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. Turn to me and be gracious to me. Give your strength to your servant and save the son of your maidservant. Show me a sign of favor that those who hate me may see and be put to shame, because you, Lord, have helped me and comforted me." Well, it's been mentioned already several different times that we live in a day and an age that's kind of strange. It kind of feels like junior high, if I try to put it in perspective. Everybody's trying to figure out just where they fit in, and you're trying to figure out from week to week what you're supposed to look like, what you're allowed to say, what you're not allowed to say, at least for this week. And then you wait and you buckle up and try to do it again next week. Those who've seen large-scale sickness and civil unrest in the past know that life goes on. But even with even liberal secularists wondering out loud at the pace of change within our culture, there is a feel of something that's unprecedented in this hour in American history. To borrow the language of Psalm 46, it feels as though the earth is giving way, the mountains are being moved into the heart of the sea, its waters are roaring and foaming, and the mountains are trembling at its swelling. So where do we go? Where do we go when life shakes us to our core? Well, Psalm 46 suggests that we go back to God, who's a refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. And when we do, we find his invitation to be the same as it's always been. Be still and know that I am God. Now listen to why he says, be still, and what it means to know that I am God. He says, I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. This earth, this broken earth, this strange earth, world in which we live, is the world in which God himself will receive glory. So hang on for the ride, because it's quite a ride, but we know where it ends. But how do we go back to God? How do we do this? How do we do this process of being still and knowing him? This summer we're going to work through a series that should help us to do that. I've entitled the series, Who We Are and Why. It's meant to take us through our philosophy of ministry as a church. For the past several years, I've worked through this material with the deacons, and it's been a good time for us to talk through together. I don't know that I've taken a while, though, to preach it together to us in a formal setting. But the goal here through this series is not to preach our philosophy okay, which is just man's words. Rather, the philosophy is simply a gridwork or a skeleton that helps provide some structure or support for who we are and what we do. So the goal is to go back and preach through the anchor texts that provide this structural network for us. So you may not find anything new in these sermons, but my prayer is that you'll discover fresh strength to keep going in the work that God's called you to do in a strangely broken world, in a strangely strange time. And so these are anchor texts. Psalm 86, for me in particular, is one of those texts that I've gone back to for years and years and years and years. All of my married life, this has been, even as I was in college, this text has been the text that I've gone to. Call it a life verse, call it a life text, but verse 11 where he says, "Unite my heart to fear your name." That was kind of the phrase that jumped out at me and said, yes, I want all of my life to be all about him. So I've gone back to Psalm 86 over and over and over, and especially at times when it seems like the world is caving in on me. Why am I here? What am I doing? And Psalm 86 helps me to answer that question. I think you'll see where it fits in. But before we jump into the text, I want us to start at the very beginning, which is a very good place to start, right? At least that's what Julie Andrews says. Okay, the mission statement. We exist as a church to glorify God by leading people to an individual passion to know God through His Word and a corporate effort to make God known in His world. Now, this is our mission statement. It's also stated as our purpose. It's a part of our constitution. This is what we've written into who we are as a church. Okay, from this little mission statement, we have five objectives that we'd like us to look at. We exist as a church, number one, to glorify God. That's in line number one because it's most important. Okay, so what does it mean to glorify God? What does that look like? How do we flesh that out? Well, we do that by leading people to an individual passion to know God through His Word. And so knowing God becomes how we glorify God. But not just knowing God, because when we really know God, we'll love God. And if we don't love God, then in fact we do not know God. At least that's our presupposition from Scripture and so on. That if you don't love God, you don't know God. But when you do know Him, you can't help but love Him. And so what does it mean to glorify God? It means to bring people into a place where they know God in such a way that they're excited about the God they know. Secondly, it requires a corporate effort to make Him known. Not just individuals. God saves individuals, but He saves individuals to be a part of a body. And so there's a big emphasis on the fact that we are a body. We are a Spirit-filled community, a new covenant community, where the end has already begun. It's an already but not yet. As we wait for God to continue the work that He's begun in every one of us as individuals in connecting us to His body. And so to be a part of the body means that's first what we are, and then from what we are comes everything that we do. A corporate effort to make Him known in the world. That is, to be engaged in bringing Him glory. In talking about Him to one another, that's edification. In talking about Him to those who are outsiders, that's evangelism. But it's our job, because we are the body of Christ, to do the work that He's called us to do, to bring Him glory in every arena that He's placed us in life. And so we looked at that in the book of Colossians. It looks like showing Him and letting His life live out in the marriages in which we find ourselves, the families in which we live. It looks like the jobs that we're called to do. God calls us to live out His life in our world, to bring glory to Him. But you see that these last two lines, the end of them here, knowing God through His Word and making Him known to His world. So we've kind of consolidated that, synthesized that down. We've put it into this little motto that you see on our bulletins. You'll see it on our website. You'll see it many different places around here. Knowing God through His Word, showing God to His world. Did you ever read that and say, why is that a motto that we just picked out of nowhere? It didn't come out of nowhere. It came out of our philosophy of ministry, which we hope comes out of the Bible. I want us to change it maybe into a proposition this morning that looks like this. Who are we? Well, we as God's people are a people called to know God through His Word and to show God to His Word. That's what it means to be the people of God. I love Psalm 86 because it's going to break down almost right in the middle. Verses 1 through 10 is going to talk about knowing God. And then verses 11 down through verse 17 is going to talk about showing God. What does this look like, knowing God and showing God? We're not going to delve into every single verse in this text. I've spent a lot of time in Psalm 86. I could spend more time than you want to spend today in Psalm 86. But the goal is to try to give you the big picture. Okay, I want you to look at your Bible. I hope that you have an English translation in front of you. Maybe you have a Hebrew Bible. Sarah might. Maybe you have the Greek Septuagint in front of you. But in your English Bible, it should look like this. In verse 1, it says, "Incline your ear, O Lord," or it says, "Bow down your ear, O Lord." And you'll note that the word Lord there is all capitals, right? Capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. There's only four times that the word Lord is capitalized, all caps, in this psalm. Those four times break the psalm down into four different sections. So it starts out in verse 1 with this name of Yahweh. Do this, Yahweh, and you'll come down to verse 5, and each of these sections closes with a because clause. Do this, Yahweh. The idea is the one who is, the living God. Do this, O living God, verse 5, because you are what? You are good. Do this, O God, because you are good. Verse 6, you'll see again that the word Yahweh there is in all caps. Give ear, O Lord, to my prayer, because, verse 10, you are what? You are great. Do this, God, because you are good. Do this, God, because you are great. Okay, very, very simple outline for the first half of this psalm. We get to know God in His goodness, and we get to know God in His greatness. You'll see there in verse 11, teach me your way, O Yahweh, verse 13, because what? Because great is your steadfast love toward whom? Toward me. Look up at verse 5. He abounds in steadfast love toward all who call upon Him. But now we've taken it out of the theoretical form, the universal reality, and we've brought it down very personally. This God has shown me His favor. He's shown His steadfast love toward me. Verse 14 begins another section, but it doesn't have the name of Yahweh there. Keep looking. Where does that name of Yahweh come in verses 14 through 17? Was that? In verse 17, right at the very end. Actually, he closes out the whole psalm by taking that name of God and putting it in at the end. It's kind of a climactic way, the way he structured it. He says, God, do this for me. He explains what the problem is in verse 14. There's a band of ruthless men who's seeking my life. That's the reality. But the second reality is verse 15. But you, God, are this kind of God. So because you're this kind of God, verse 16, save me. He says, turn to me, be gracious, give strength, save me, show me a sign. Because it's you, Yahweh, who's helped me and comforted me. God, you're this kind of a God. God, you're this kind of a God. God, you're this kind of a God. Let everybody see what kind of a God you are. I love Psalm 86. It's just structured so beautifully. So let's look at this first half of the psalm. What does life look like for the people of God? It looks first like this. Life for God's people is governed by the reality of our God. And we very simple, we broke it down into two sections. He's uniquely good. He's uniquely great. Verse 1, incline your ear to me, O Lord. Answer me. Because why? Do this for me because I am great and powerful, and you should listen to me. Is that what your translation says? Throw it away if it does, okay? You should listen to me, God, because I am poor and needy. Now, wait a minute. You have to understand something. You you didn't come to the gods in the ancient Near East and expect them to feel sorry for you. You didn't come to the gods and expect them to look at you and say, oh, the poor dear. Maybe I should reach in and help them. You had to impress the gods. You had to show them that you were worthy for them to listen to you, to pay attention to you. Because those who are weak and needy and poor, they're a dime a dozen. Okay? Nobody would get their attention to the gods if they came saying, oh, I'm poor me. Okay. But David comes to his God, the only God who is, and he uses God's name there. Yahweh, the God who is, would you listen to me? And here's the credentials that I bring. I need you. I need you. I've got nothing. You got everything. But that's the kind of God that you are. You're compassionate and you're accessible. In verse 2, he says, preserve my life, for I am godly. Oh, okay, here's where he starts beating his chest a little bit. Okay, I'm godly. Listen to me. Well, you have to understand what that term is. He uses a term that mirrors the language of the character of God. I am a chassidim. I am one who is a covenant lover of you, and therefore you are a covenant lover of me. Or rather, you are a covenant lover of me, and therefore I am a covenant lover of you. But the whole point of this I am godly phrase means that God, we're bound together by covenant. I belong to you. I'm one of yours. And so he's going to call himself here in verse 2, your servant. Save your servant who trusts in you. God, he doesn't say it in so many terms, but you owe it to me. You're my God. I'm your servant and I owe you everything, but you've given me a job that's too big. I can't do this by myself. I don't have the resources to do this by myself, but you do. It's your job, and you've called me to it. And he's writing this, remember, as the one who's been anointed to be king of Israel. You talk about a job that you can't do in your own strength. Welcome to David's life. He said, God, I can't do this. I am your servant, but I can't do this. You've got to help me. You owe it to me because I'm your servant. You've got vested interest in me. God, I'm yours. And so he appeals to God, who's jealously faithful. God, I'm reminding you of your covenant, your covenant. Would you be faithful to me because of your covenant? And he's not sticking it in God's face. He's saying it as one who loves God. He says, God, this is my hope. This is my life. This is what I'm banking on. Would you fulfill your covenant that you've graciously made with your servant? Verse 3, he says, be gracious to me, my master. The word L-O-R-D, not capitalized, means master. The title, Lord, would be appropriate there. Okay. My Lord, my Master, would you please be gracious to me? Because I cry to you all the day. The word gracious there is the idea of being abundantly kind. It depicts a heartfelt response by someone who has something to give towards somebody who has a need. It's an action of a superior to an inferior who has no real claim for gracious treatment, but he has the resources to meet that need, and he's asking for God to be gracious. It has the idea of finding favor in the other's eyes. I think that's all we're going to say on that for now. But he asks God to be gracious to me. Verse 4, gladden the soul of your servant, for to you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. The idea of lifting up my soul means the way that he has it written, the verb tense here is habitual. I continually lift up my soul. I pour out my heart to you day after day after day after day. Why do I do this? Because there's only one thing that can satisfy my soul, God. It's you. So would you gladden my soul? I think the King James here has rejoice my heart. But the idea is to bring joy to me. God, I come to you. Why? Because you are the source of my joy. I'm banking on you to be that source of my joy. I could look other places for joy. I could go down to the bar. I could go down to the strip club. I could go down to the casino. I could go
to drugs. I could go to alcohol. I could go to whatever. I could find a joy or happiness in a lot of places. But that's a joy that doesn't last. I know where to find lasting joy. I know where to find true joy. I know where to find real joy. And God, it's only in you. And so glad in my heart, because you are the source of my joy. And so he's coming to this God, and he brings all of these petitions, and then he wraps it up with a because in verse 5. Because you, God, you, my master, are good, and you're forgiving. He uses two terms, and we'll see a little bit later, that he's borrowing from a passage back in the book of Exodus, chapters 33 and 34, when Israel had walked away from God, right at the very beginning of them becoming a nation, at Mount Sinai, when Moses is up on the mount. Well, he's still up on the mount for 40 days. They build themselves a golden calf. They sin. They break the first three commandments all in one fatal blow. And Moses is interceding on their behalf. And God comes down and visits Moses. And Moses asks God if he would show him his glory. And God says, let me tell you what I'll do. I'll show you my goodness. And I'll reveal my ways. And he speaks his name to Moses there. And he says, I want you to understand who I am, Moses. I'm a God who's merciful and compassionate. A God who's long of face or long of nose. The idea is long suffering. When my face gets red, it takes a long time to reach the end is the idea. Okay. So all of you who think you have literal translations of the Bible, you don't, unless it says God is long of nose. Okay, it means long suffering. He says, I'm abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. And then he kind of wraps things up and says, I forgive iniquities, transgressions, sin. And that word sin we kind of think is a generic term for sin, meaning wrong, and it is kind of a generic term that means to miss the mark. But the whole point of missing the mark is I'm not shooting at this target and just falling short of this glory of God, Romans 3:23. The idea of sin is I'm shooting at an entirely different target. I'm shooting at the glory of Ryan. I'm missing the mark because I'm shooting at the wrong target. I've written the wrong hero into the story. I've crafted a story that's all about me. Therefore, I've fallen short of the glory of God because I've been seeking my own. And so in this pericope back in Exodus chapter 33 and 34, God starts out by saying, I'll show you my goodness. It looks like forgiveness. And he takes the front and the back of this whole story and he weaves them together in this one little phrase here, for you are good and forgiving. And then he takes the climax of God's name. You abound in steadfast love toward anyone who banks on you being the God that you are. That's a great place for this first part of the chapter to start. God, would you bend down to me because you're a good God? And would you be that good God for me? Now in verse 6, he makes the same repetition of the same request. Bow down your ear or give ear, O Lord, to my prayer. Listen to my plea for grace. In the day of my trouble, I call upon you because you're alive. You can answer me because you're a living God. You can hear me. You can move to my rescue. And I'm asking that you would. And so this God is uniquely great. He says in verse 7 that this God is eternally contemporary. In the day of my trouble, I'll call on you because you answer me. Well, what if I have a day of trouble tomorrow? What if I have a day of trouble next week? What if I have a day of trouble next year? Is he still going to have enough of his godness to meet my... God is always God, and he's always the same God. He's eternally contemporary. Have you ever thought about God not really being the same God for you as he was for maybe David? Well, yeah, of course God did that for David, because David was David, right? And, well, God used to do those kind of things. Now, you maybe didn't say it in those kind of words, but have you ever thought, God's not going to do that for me because God just doesn't do those kind of things anymore. Have you ever thought like that? God just doesn't do those kind of things anymore. Okay? If that's the way you think, then you're missing out on your God. God gives us these stories because he wants us to understand that he's the same kind of God that writes himself into your story in ways that are amazing. You want to call them miracles? He's probably not going to separate waters for you, okay, so that you can drive through or walk through on dry ground. He's probably not going to answer Amelia's wish for a Land Rover for a graduation present. Okay, that's probably not the miracle that God's going to do for you, because he doesn't do those kind of things. But is he still a God who can heal? I mean, inexplicably, does he get involved in medical? Absolutely. Is he a God that can give you real answers when you've got real troubles? Well, James said so. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men stingily. Oh, no, I'm sorry. He gives to all men liberally. And he doesn't chew you out for asking. Is he really a God who still provides financially? I'll answer that one. Yes. Time and time and time again, I've seen God meet financial needs that there's no reason. I had no resource. I had no recourse. But God met my bill as I followed his plan for my life. If you think God doesn't work like this anymore, my friend, you're missing the point of the story. He wants you to get to know what he's done in the past, because what he's done in the past reveals the kind of God that he is. And he wants you to bank on him being that kind of God in the future. And so he says, this God is eternally contemporary. In verse 8, he's supremely existent. Among the gods, even though there aren't any, but those that others would claim, there's no one like this God. To go to any other God, you have to prove yourself worthy. And so this God is so gracious, so compassionate, so tender, so kind, so near. There's no God like this God. In verse 8, there are no works like unto his works. Okay. Has there ever been a God that's actually pushed back the waters so that they stood in a pile? You ever tried piling water? Okay, it doesn't work very well. You go down to the sea and you build sandcastles and you try holding back the waters from ruining your sandcastle, right? We find out very early in life we can't hold back waters, but God can. In fact, God can not just do it once with the Red Sea, he does it a second time with the Jordan River. And not only does this God push back the waters, he walks on the waters. He defies all of the laws of nature because he's God. Verses 9 and 10, this God is ultimately sovereign. All the nations that he has made will bring glory to his name. Why? Because verse 10, he is great and does great things, wondrous things, amazing things, because he alone is God. Look back up at verse 2. You are my God. You alone are God. We have two phrases of the Shema here. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God. The Lord alone. The Lord is one. This unique God. He's great. The idea here in verse 10 is he does what he does because he is who he is. He does great things because he's a great God. He does amazing things because he's an amazing God. He does wonderful things because he's a wonderful God. It's very similar to Psalm 119, verse 68. You are good and therefore you do good, because we do what we do because we are who we are. God does what he does because he is who he is. Psalm 119, verse 137. He is righteous, and therefore all of his judgments are righteous. So Psalm 86, verse 10. He does great things because he is this great God. Number two, the second half of the psalm, life for God's people is consumed with the glory of God. So he says in verse 11, God, would you do something for me? Would you teach me your way? Here I want us to see very quickly that ours is a unique privilege and ours is a unique providence. What's our privilege? Well, our privilege is to get to know God more. And there's two ways or two vehicles by which we get to know God better. He says in verse 11, teach me your way. Now, not just the works of God. Keep your fingers here in Psalm 86 and go up to Psalm 95. There's a difference between God's works and God's ways. God's works point to God's ways. But if we're not careful, all we see is God's works. And then we want to bank on God to do special works for us. But we get disappointed because we've never connected God's works to God's ways. So Psalm 95, verse 7, that last line in verse 7. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as on the day of Massa in the wilderness, where your fathers put me to the test. They put me to the proof, though they had seen my, what? They had seen my work, but, go down to verse 10, for 40 years I loathed this generation, and said there are people who go astray in their heart, because though they saw my works, they have not known my what? They have not known my ways. And so David says here, God, would you please show me your ways? Don't let me just see your works. Don't let me see the awesome things that you do and not connect them to the awesome God that you are. Let me get to know you more. In fact, when Moses is up on the mount, he's been up there for 40 days. 40 days. And the children of Israel said, Moses, he's too big. You go talk to him. He's going to kill us. So Moses goes. I love how Exodus says it in chapter 20. I think it's verse 20. And Moses went up into the dark cloud. Thing. Boom. He goes up into God's presence. I mean, there's lightnings, there's thunderings. And then the people of Israel sin. He goes back down. He comes back up to talk to God. And he says, God, would you do something for me? Would you show me your glory? Can you imagine how audacious this is? Okay, for 40 days, Moses has been in God's presence. There's some lightnings, thunderings, trumpetings. Mountain's been shaking. He's like, Yeah, thanks, God. Would you show me your glory? That all you got? And he's not trying to be disrespectful. He says, God, I've begun to see your ways, but would you show me more? Please, would you show me more? Is that where you're at in your relationship with God today? Not like, that all you got? But God, given what you've shown me so far, what more do you have in store for me? I want to press in. I want to know you more. And that's where the psalmist is, because that's our privilege. And since our God's eternal, since our God is infinite, there's no end of pressing into this God and finding out more of his greatness. And so David says, I want to know you through your ways. And then he says, would you please do something else for me? Would you unite my heart to fear your name? The name of God is the glory of God. Because the name of God reveals the ways of God. And so this name of God is not what we perceive God to be, but what he reveals himself to be. In Exodus 3, he says, you know who I am? I am who I am. Oh, thanks, that's helpful. No, really, it is. I am. Think of anything apart from me. Where does it derive its existence? From me. Well, what about the gods? Okay, let's talk about the other gods. What are they? They are not. I am. They are not. Okay, let's talk about that. God says, you want to know me? I am who I am. He comes down to Exodus 34. I am the God who is good. What does my goodness look like? It looks like being merciful, compassionate, long-suffering, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness for you. For you, when you walk away from me, I don't turn away from you. That's the kind of God I am. And so his prayer is, would you help me? Would you let me know you more through your ways, through your name? And there's two means of knowing God more. He asks God to teach me. Not a Hebrew lesson, but the stem of this verb is the idea of causing event. Would you teach me? Would you cause me to know? Would you train my heart so that experientially I gain the muscle memory of knowing you? Would you cause this event to happen in my life? The second way that we get to know God is through this uniting of the heart. Here it's a different stem. And again, not to have a Hebrew lesson, but it's not so much to cause an event as to bring about a state. Would you make my heart united? Would you bring me into a place that I can't bring myself? Would you make all of my heart all consumed with your glory? I can't do that. And so God, you're going to have to bring me to this perfect state. And that's what he asks of God, so that he would know this God more. But also, it's our privilege to make this God known. And so he says in verse 11, I want my own life to be changed by the reality of this God. I want you to unite my heart to fear your name. I want you to teach me your ways so that I can walk in your truth. When I get to know God, I want my steps to line up with his steps. In fact, if I don't line up my steps with his steps, it means that I don't know this God. I don't know his ways. And so he wants my works to line up with God's works. He wants his worship to line up with the worth of his God. So he says there in verse 12, I give thanks to you, O Lord my God, with my whole heart. The whole heart that you've united around your name, I give back to you in worship. But not just so that my life can be changed by the reality of God, but that so others' lives can be changed by this same reality. And so he says at the end of verse 12, I will glorify your name forever. The idea of glorify is to make weighty God's name in front of others publicly. I want others to see what kind of a great God you are. I want them to see it through me. As you change me, I want them to see not me, but you. And so he says, this is the privilege that I have to know God more and to make God known in front of others. And mine is a unique providence. There's a problem here in verse 14. We finally get to the problem. He's caught between two competing realities. Reality number one is this. God, there's a band of ruthless men who seek my life. Insolent men have risen up against me. The idea is they're contemptuous. They're violent. This is the reality of my life right now. But I love the first word in verse 15. But you. But you. This is the reality. But you. You know, that is really, really, really a good way to pray. When you're having a lousy day, tell God about it. Say, God, this is the reality today. It stinks. And you can tell him how bad it stinks and what stinks looks like. It looks like this. This is a stinky day. But don't stop there. You really didn't start praying until you say two more words. But you, because that's the greater reality in your life. You may be having a lousy day. Okay, honestly, I don't know how lousy your day looks. But it's never the total reality. It's only part of the reality. The reality is life stinks, but God, and he's this kind of a God. And so that's where he turns his attention. And as he focuses on this goodness of God, he starts focusing more on the name of God. Verse 15. In fact, this is exactly the name that's written in Exodus 34, verse 6. But you, my master, are a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. And he quotes the name of God back to God, not because God doesn't know his name. He quotes the name of God back to God because this name of God has impacted him in a unique way. God, here's who you said you are. Would you be this kind of a God for me today? That's the point. Would you be this kind of a God for me today? This is who you say you are. I'm banking on you being this God. In the midst of this situation, I'm banking on you being this kind of a God. Verse 16, for me. For me. And so, with all of the different words there, we're not going to take time to unpack all of those. We've talked about them a little bit. He says in verse 16, so turn to me and be gracious to me. Turn your face on me. It's the blessing of Numbers chapter 6, verses 24 through 26, where God says, in this way put my name on my people. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you. May his countenance turn toward you in favor is the idea. God, would you turn toward me in this kind of way? And when you turn toward me, would you give strength to your servant? Would you give strength to your servant and save this son of your handmaid? Verse 17, he says, show me a sign of your favor. Actually, he says, make me a sign of your favor. Do with me a sign of your favor. So not just like, throwing out the fleece. Oh, yep, it's wet. Others not. Okay, it's dry. Everything else is wet. He's not just saying, show me a sign for me. He's saying, make my life a sign for others. So you see how it comes down in verse 17? Show me a sign of your favor so that those who hate me, so that they may see that you've helped me and comforted me. David says, I want my life to be a revelation of the kind of God that you are. So ours is the privilege of God's providence. We belong to God. We could say this way, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. That's what he's saying. God, would you make my life to be a revelation of the kind of shepherd that you are? There's one last thing that we may not see just in the language here of the psalm. But life for God's people is viewed through the story of God. As I was working through this again this week, I've worked on this lots of times, but I never quite put this together. This psalm is saturated with Bible language. It is Bible, but it's saturated with Bible language up to this point. One writer said it's like the gospel, it's like the revelation of John, and he doesn't just throw in bits and pieces of the Bible. The whole thing is drenched in Bible as you read it. That's the way this psalm is put together. Two stories David's picking up in this psalm. The first is obviously Moses up on the mountain. And he focuses on God's transcendent relationship with everybody. God is who he is, and he's always all that he is. Okay? This is the kind of God. He's a compassionate, merciful, long-suffering, abounding in steadfast and faithfulness kind of God. And he's that for everybody, always. That's the first story he picks up on. But you don't see it until you take some time to drill down on the language in verses 1 through 5, but he's also picking up on another story. Now, it's not quite so plain and standing out in front of you. But in 1 Samuel chapter 1 and 2, in fact, Samuel being the one who anointed David as king, Samuel being the one that all of Israel knew was a prophet of God, bringing the word of God, David picks up on what Samuel wrote down in his own story about his mother. There's some words up in chapter, or verse 1, verse 2, that we see only in the book of Deuteronomy and in the story of Hannah. When David says, God, I am poor and needy, we only find those two words brought together in that kind of phrase in the book of Deuteronomy, and when Hannah prays and says, God, you're a God who helps the poor and needy. When we come down to that word godly in verse 2, we only see it one time in the book of Deuteronomy and one time in Hannah's prayer where she says, God, you take care of the godly. Now you think about Hannah's life and you think about the injustice that was being poured out on her because of Peninnah, who had many kids and poor Hannah had none. And she would mock her and make fun of her and provoke her and make her cry. And David says, God, I'm kind of being chased like that. I've got ruthless, violent men who could care less about me. And so I'm turning to you. I've got nothing. I can't do anything to get out from this one. Would you turn to your servant? And actually, in 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 11, three times, that's Hannah's prayer. Turn to your servant. Help your servant. Help your servant. I've got nothing, but you're mine. And I belong to you. It's not the same word. He uses the boy word, she uses the girl word, but it's the same idea. Okay? And so he picks up on that same theme when he says down in verse 16, would you rescue the son of your maidservant? He's not talking about his mom. He's not. He says, I fall in the line of the godly like Hannah. Not that his mom wasn't a Christian, but he's referencing this line of the godly, this heritage of the godly. If you helped Hannah, your maidservant, would you help me? In fact, remember, there's not a king in Israel in those days. Go back to 1 Samuel chapter 2. There's not a king in Israel when Hannah's praying this prayer. But God gives her her heart's desire. He gives her a son. He miraculously gives her a baby when she couldn't have one. Because she was just asking God to be that kind of a God for her. But look at what she prays now in verse 9. She prays, this is the kind of God. Well, let's back up. Let's go just a little bit further. Let's back up to verse 3. Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth, because Yahweh, the living God, is a God of knowledge. By him all actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble bind on strength. Those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, but those who were hungry have ceased to hunger. The barren has borne seven. She who has many children is now forlorn. The Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. He makes poor. He makes rich. He brings low. He exalts. He raises up the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the ash heap, to make them sit with princes and inherit a seat of honor, because the pillars of the earth belong to the God who is, and on them he has set up the world. This God will guard the feet of his faithful ones, his godly ones. But the wicked shall be cut off in darkness, for not by might shall a man prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken in pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give what to his whom? He will give strength to his king and exalt the power of his anointed. Go back to Psalm 86. Look what he prays in verse 16. Give your strength to your king, to your servant. Your handmaid has already prayed for this, God. Would you give me the salvation that she sings about? Would you grant me that kind of salvation? Would you give your salvation to your anointed one? Would you do that for me? And David, writing to God, pouring out his heart to God, mirroring that same language of Hannah pouring out her soul to the Lord, he views his story in light of these stories. Okay. Well, that's David, because he's the king of Israel. Right. But here's the point. This same God is your God. We're going to close with Psalm 119, verse 132. Psalm 119, verse 132. The point of Psalm 186 is this. Don't think of God as a God who used to do these kind of things way back then. Psalm 119, verse 132. Turn to me and be gracious to me, as is your way with those who love your name. Or Psalm, or King James Version says, as you used to do to those who love you. As you used to do to those who love you. God, love me the way you've loved others in the past. My friend, if you're God's child, life for you is governed by the reality of your God. He's good and he's great. If you're God's child, life is consumed for you by the glory of God. You have the privilege of knowing him more and making him known. And you have the privilege of his providence always at work in your life. And then if you're a child of God, You must view your life through God's story. You've got to know who He is for everybody always. And you must know that God comes close and draws inside the story with those who belong to Him. That's you. That's you. If you're not looking at your story this way, then you're not looking at your story right. You're not looking at life right, because this is the life of those who belong to God. So we said at the beginning, God's people are those who know Him through His Word, and they make Him known to His world, or knowing God through His Word and showing God to His world. Over the next couple weeks, we're going to see a lot of this. We're going to talk about knowing God. That means we've got to look up. We've got to look in this book. We've got to look at God if we're going to know Him. And when we know Him, we have to love Him. Because if we don't love Him, we don't know Him. But we also have to look at what He makes us. He makes us to belong to Him. And so as we look up and we bow down, we also have to plug in. We have to plug into this body called the church. We have to plug into the people of God. Because if we can't do relationships well here, guess what? We're not going to do relationships well out there. These are people who are on our team, right? If we can't get along with the people who are on our team, how are we going to provide any attraction to those who are on the outside? So Jesus says, by this will all men know that you're my disciples. If you have love one for another, right? Plugging in. And then reaching out. We're going to see this over and over and over again over the course of this summer. I hope you don't get tired of it, because it's going to be God's Word where we seek to derive these principles from. But actually, it looks more than like this. It looks kind of more like this. Once you know God, He calls you to love Him, and He changes who you are from the inside out so that who you are plays out in everything you do. Not perfectly, but more and more you look like Jesus. And so that's what we're going to be talking about. When we do this, we do exactly what we're designed to do in 1 Peter chapter 2. You're going to get there in just this next week, right? Okay. In 1 Peter chapter 2, we're a holy nation, a royal priesthood, that we may proclaim broadly the excellence of Him who's called us out of darkness into His marvelous light. And so our little symbol here, we've got the gray area before the cross, and everything after the cross is white. Why? Because He's called us out of darkness. Why did He call us out of darkness? So that we can show the world the kind of God that we have. So I hope you're excited about Psalm 86. I hope you're excited about what God has called us to be as His children. Let's go ahead and pray.